Welcome to Conversations on Healthcare with Mark Maselli and Margaret Flinter, a show where we speak to the top thought leaders in health innovation, health policy, care delivery, and the great minds who are shaping the healthcare of the future. This week, Mark and Margaret speak with Jitin Asnani, founding executive director of the Commonwealth Alliance, a not-for-profit trade association of healthcare and technology organizations that are working together to create universal access to health data nationwide. The organization has thousands of providers, payers, electronic health entities, and organizations utilizing their platform to share health data and exchange health information. Lori Robertson also checks in. Managing editor of FactCheck.org looks at misstatements spoken about health policy in the public domain, separating the fake from the facts. And we end with a bright idea that's improving health and well-being in everyday lives. If you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And you can ask Alexa to play the program Conversations on Healthcare. Now, stay tuned for our interview with Jitin Asnani of the Commonwealth Alliance on Conversations on Healthcare.
We're speaking today with Jitin Asnani, first executive director of the Commonwealth Health Alliance, a not-for-profit trade association of healthcare and technology organizations working together to create universal access to health data nationwide. Prior to that, he was director of Athena Health, where he helped build a cloud-based interoperability platform. He also contributed to the federal advisory committees for Athena Health and HL7 Argonaut Project, as well as serving in the Office of the National Coordinator for Health IT and the Department of Health and Human Services. He earned his bachelor's in science at MIT and earned his MBA from Harvard Business School. Jitin, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
My pleasure to be here.
Yeah, I think everybody knows that as the amount of available health data continues to grow, interoperability of health information systems has also grown as a crucial issue and problem to solve. And I think that's one of the founding goals of the Commonwealth Alliance since your inception a number of years ago. And now you just came back from the HIMSS Global Conference. And certainly this issue of interoperability loomed large. And I wonder if you could help our listeners understand how much closer we've come to the goal of making health data readily available to patients who seek it and for providers who rely on it.
Absolutely. You know, this is a never-ending journey, to be quite frank. The quest to become perfectly interoperable and have data share so seamlessly across systems that, you know, has to actually continue as medicine itself evolves and as the types of data out there evolve, in response to kind of, you know, changes in therapeutics and diagnosis abilities and so on. The big first step for us that we're trying to accomplish is to get the spigots running. 10 years ago when I entered this industry, there was virtually no multi-party data exchange happening. There was some point-to-point exchange, exceedingly expensive, but there was no way to get a whole party to connect to each other except in small localized environments where, you know, small groups of players had come together. Now, here we are with things like Commonwealth leading the way in terms of enabling broad-scale, nationwide, cross-community exchange of data in support of treatment, patient access, and other purposes. And so, you know, if you look at a Commonwealth network, we enable more than 11,000 different sites, clinical facilities all across the U.S. to be able to exchange data, and that number is just growing by thousands every year. And we're working with others who are trying to enable such goals as well across the ecosystem. And so we really are at a place now where the pipes are there, water is running, and now we're working on making the data that flows to them better. And as we work on that, we're starting to think about how do we make the insights from the data more actionable. And as we get through that, we think about how do we make those insights actually turning them into action, you know, to really drive execution in terms of, better patient care. So the journey continues, and now we've taken through Commonwealth and through the work that's done both within the Commonwealth and with partners outside Commonwealth, we're at the stage where we can say, yes, we're mm-hmm. very close to being at the precipice of stage two, where the data is really flowing, and we need to make it more insightful so that providers can use it in a wide variety of contextual situations with patients.
Well, and we have seen such a dramatic shift in the American health system over this past decade. Really, Mark, I think it's a decade and a half since we went live with electronic health records. And over this past decade, especially, most health systems have gotten off paper and onto electronic health records. But many people say that the large EHR entities, the major players in the marketplace, have made the interoperability more difficult than it needs to be. We're curious about the genesis of the Commonwealth Alliance. Where did the idea for this and the identification of the need for a new organization, the Commonwealth Alliance, to exist? Who are the partners that we're involved in? Maybe you could just tell us a little more about how these entities are building an infrastructure that facilitates interoperability. Maybe go one level deeper and tell us a little more about that infrastructure that's really going to make for a better flow of health data between systems and, of course, to the patients as well.
Yeah, now if you think about EHRs and their adoption, there's been a very slow pace from, you know, call it 1970 or so. So over the course of 40 years, there was a very slow pace of EHR adoption across the industry. But it was, a slow and plodding effort. And, you know, less than 20% of all of healthcare was electronic. And then came the EHR incentive programs out of the HITECH Act. And what you had was an artificial kind of pumping up of this part of the industry where there was an incentivized push for our provider organizations to adopt EHRs. And on the one hand, you could say, hey, this is great. Provider organizations really, you know, started going to, you know, the electronic world, which is where they should have been going. On the flip side, you know, having worked at an EHR vendor, I can tell you that it was, because it was an artificial pump, it was a land grab. And you had to run out into the market with what you had and whatever you could build on the fly to try to have an opportunity to get part of that sudden opportunity to electronify these paper-based practices and institutions. And so meaningful use in some ways got a little bit backwards. They jumped to electronification without thinking about the interoperability or as interoperability as a follow-on. And what they're driving was the adoption of EHRs, which were not designed for interoperability. Interoperability is not a problem when very few people have your system or have a system that's electronic in the first place. When you're living in a paper-based world, your interoperability solution is a fax machine. And so interoperability was great in a paper-based world for paper-based interoperability. I'm being a little tongue-in-cheek there, of course, but the reality is that that was not a problem. It suddenly became a problem in a very quick time frame, artificially, because of meaningful use. And what happened in 2012 and 13 time frame, when the EHRs started realizing, hey, this is the way the world is going, we're all going to have electronic records, you know, whether mine or my competitors, the reality is to have these records be able to exchange with each other. And given kind of the knowledge of how federal regulation tends to act, coming from top down, as in from the federal government on down to the EHR vendors, was just bound not to be as good a solution as if the industry had just taken it themselves. So we took it upon ourselves, you know, at that time when Commonwealth was just founded, it was just five substantial vendors, Athena Health, Greenway Health, Cerner, Allscripts, and McKesson. So those five got together and said, hey, we believe that data exchange is going to be critical. We should be enabling caregivers across the country to be able to find the patient's data, regardless of what EHR record their current or previous providers have used. And so we came together and decided we create basically a shared services platform, which included a record locator service and a patient index so that we really could tell where the patient has been, regardless of what EHR they're using. And something wonky, I'll call it the data broker, but it allowed us to be able to exchange data amongst each other without having to build point-to-point connections to find the data, whether that patient was on the Greenway Health EHR or seen by a provider using an Athena Health EHR. And that was the genesis of it. It was this notion that we know where we need to go as an industry. We know how we can get there. Let's build something that we know works because we are EHRs who are going to be on the hook to build them. And then let's open it up so that the entire industry can join us, the government can join us, and we really can take care of the patients across the care continuum.
I love the notion that you think we're on this precipice of having the data flow. And certainly to make that happen, we need to sort of understand the standards that are required required to facilitate the building of this infrastructure. And there's this growing enthusiasm for something called FHIR, and that's not the flame, but rather this is a fast healthcare interoperability resources, FHIR technology. And that was developed by the folks at HL7, the Global Authority for Interoperability in Health Information Technology. And HL7 has defined their goals for advancing interoperability through the Argonaut project. And I'm wondering if you could tell us more about the role of FHIR and why it's so vital to scaling up innovation in the health information technology arena.
So I was one of the founders of the Argonaut project as well. A number of the founders of the Commonwealth Health Alliance were also founders of the Argonaut project. So what is FHIR? It comes down to this. FHIR enables two things. It is based off of much more modern 21st century internet protocols to share electronic data, and it represents a data format for exchanging what an industry luminary named Wes Rischel likes to call molecules of data. In other words, share with me just the data I'm interested in, not necessarily the entire patient chart or the entire encounter summary. It's a little bit like the difference between sharing a tweet versus sharing a full Word document. And so the ability to work with modern protocols means now you can attract into this industry a younger or newer generation of participants from Silicon Valley. You can recruit folks from, you know, technical colleges and universities across the country to come and participate meaningfully in developing innovations without requiring a, you know, lengthy participation in the industry in the first place to really understand how these, you know, old ancient protocols that we use typically in this industry that, you know, have been the mainstay of the industry these last 40-something years. So if you get it right, and everybody implements the same modern protocols everywhere, in other words, actually standardize it, then that means that somebody who's building a startup can work with several different EHRs without having to rebuild their software again and again. Then that second part about the data itself, the data being available in molecules, means you can participate and have other types of exchange. The fact that you now can share, you know, just immunizations or just allergies, the fact that you can kind of pick and choose mm-hmm. the type of data you want to exchange, intuitively, it should be a game changer. You should be able to create innovations that are very, very focused on particular things people need, like being able to find immunizations for your child or something, you know, if you're going to take them to soccer camp and they need all of that. And things like Commonwealth, who provide the ability to go and find where the data is to correlate it to a single individual, become even more useful in this scenario. And in fact, it reduces our costs, because right now we do entirely document-based exchange with these old legacy systems, and our ability to participate with those participants became cheaper because everybody is now using much more modern protocols as directed by the Argonaut project.
Well, Jitin, I really appreciate your optimism and excitement about moving away from the ancient code and into this new era. Yeah, just recently, I think there was a fair amount of anticipation leading up to this year's HIMSS Global Conference. It was marked by some big announcements from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, from the administrator Seema Verna and others within HHS, who I understand announced some pretty bold new rules for advancing health data liquidity. And I understand that this rule says that by 2020, no patient should have to wait more than 24 hours to gain access to their own health records electronically and at no cost to them. That's certainly a pretty big difference from the 30 days that people have to produce those records now. This is huge. It signals a new incentive, certainly, for health systems to improve health information sharing. This is a radical shift. Tell us why you think these new CMS rules are so significant.
If you just think about what the experience is today for an individual participating in healthcare, you know, we've heard stories from our neighbors and our friends, and then we've heard it from very high-profile individuals like Seema Verma and the care of her husband, or, you know, former Vice President Biden and the care of his son, who was diagnosed with cancer and the like. And if you think about all these scenarios, the underlying theme there is just a lack of empowerment. As an individual in this country, when you're participating in your healthcare, whether your outcome is good or bad, you are a victim of the healthcare system here. That's the issue. When Commonwealth was formed, our notion was, you know, the caregiver should be able to get the data no matter where the patients received care. And the caregiver was always broadly defined to be, it could be the clinical provider, it could be the patient themselves, it could be the parents, the teachers, whoever. We expected that the bulk of the exchange would be driven by clinical providers, you know, physicians, nurses, and the like, and that has borne out to be true. But from the very beginning, it was all about enabling it for whoever it needs to have authorized access to take care of that patient. And as CMS and SNOT this rule, they've done two things. They have said that, yes, the individual must be empowered. And they focused on the individual, you know, even though I'm not sure the immediate volumes will come from the individual, although you can certainly argue that over the next 3 to 5 years, we expect more healthcare to be driven by individuals themselves. But it was a critical statement, in my opinion, that not only are we moving in the direction of more interoperability, we're really moving in the direction of greater empowerment. We have to, as individuals, feel like we have more control over the care of ourselves. And that's what I really love about the rules that have come out. And the second thing is this notion that they're really forcing adoption of these FHIR APIs. And again, to the extent that we know everywhere that the same set of APIs are going to be utilized for the majority of the health system that participates with CMS as their payer, again, that's a beautiful thing. That enables higher interoperability. Not only will it become utilized for the purposes of enabling patients to get their care, but it'll also be utilized by others who want to participate in the care. From the point of view of what Commonwealth has done in the past, we already have patients to connect to us. We have enabled it. In fact, we've enabled it for the last 3 years. And I think it's really just there's a marketplace out there that's still nascent and still developing. And this, I think, will insert the kind of confidence that a PHR or patient app developer is going to feel that, hey, yeah, if I participate here, I know for sure that other people I participate with will have the data, will have it in a format that I can reliably build software towards and actually know that I'm going to get data that I can build innovations on top of. We've already done some parts of it in Commonwealth, but the fact that CMS is really going to drive the industry to standardize and to accept the philosophical premise that the patient deserves and has a right to their data, I think will be a big boon for all of us who are just trying to make interoperability ubiquitous.
We're speaking today with Jitin Osnani, the first executive director of the Commonwealth Health Alliance, a not-for-profit trade association of healthcare and technology organizations working together to create universal access to health data nationwide. He was the director of Athena Health and was one of the founders of the Argonaut Project. Jitin, you say that we've reached an interesting pivot point where we've gone from not having enough data to all of a sudden having too much of it. And I really wanted to pull the thread in this last conversation because it seems that there's just increasing demand for information. We at our health center are engaged with the All of Us Project, Francis Collins' Million Lives Study, pairing together genomic information, health information, social determinants. There's just an enormous amount of new streams of data flooding into the system. And your sense is that there's somebody who's going to mediate this information for us. What's the next 5 years look like in terms of synthesizing this information and getting into controllable bits that they can understand and make actionable decisions based on?
You know, if you just think about the different pieces you need in your health data puzzle as a provider, you know you have disparate data sources. You have the clinical chart data, the social determinant data, the genomics data, and the like, right? A whole slew of different resources. You know you have a system that faces to you, right? An actual EHR or other HIT system, right? You don't touch and feel Commonwealth. That's sort of like the Verizon network. It's somewhere in the background doing its thing. But what you touch and feel is the equivalent of your phone, or in this case, your EHR most likely. And you need these things to kind of work together. You need to know where these data sources are and get them connected at the time you need it for the patient you need it for. And then when it comes together in your EHR, you need to know that it actually can be put together in some way that's sensible, that you can actually utilize it. Here's what I see happening, Mark. As folks realize that there is a lot more data that they need in their locality in order to be able to exchange data, I see them making a lot of bad old-fashioned point-to-point connections. Let me just connect to that local state agency that has the housing information for these patients who have socioeconomic issues, because that makes a big difference if I'm trying to bend the cost curve on diabetes in my community. By the time something like Commonwealth, which is a nationwide network, gets there, so I'm going to do that quickly. In the meantime, I'm going to connect to Commonwealth because I'll be able to get the clinical chart data on the patient. And then it's going to come up here into my EHR provided by, you know, XYZ vendor. And it's sort of kludgy, but for the patient for whom I really need that information, I will utilize it. And, you know, I see that bearing out even right now, Mark, because the, you know, participants on the Commonwealth Network who immediately started using the service to a great degree were actually PCPs who are seeing brand new patients because they were so desperate for any data that even if the data came across from some location and it was not, you know, well formatted, it was in an old document format or something, they would still at least skim through it so that they had something. So they're the least demanding customers for data. Mm-hmm. And over time, as the data has become better, we have more and more use cases where people are utilizing it in more and more situations. Mm-hmm. And I see that playing out as well. As Commonwealth expands, as state and government agencies connect to us, we'll get into more of these data sources. As EHRs, I think this is the big transformation. As EHRs make the transition from enterprise software systems that have interoperability as a feature towards interoperable web-based systems, or at least cloud-based systems that have user-facing functionality that makes you more intelligent. As we see that transformation, the experience of users is going to get better. In other words, as the goalpost moves from, hey, do I check the box on functionality, to how am I creating an experience that's so good in light of the fact that I'm seeing more and more data coming into my system. You know, as we make that transition, I think the experience for providers and caregivers with respect to the data is going to dramatically improve. My sense is that CMS has already seen this, and they are trying to drive more usability related regulation. My sense is that EHR vendors are investing more and more in this space, and some of the newest EHRs on the block kind of really think of themselves as interoperable platforms that have EHR functionality built on top of it. And so I think as the world moves in that direction, the realization that there are all these other data sources out there is it's just going to be table stakes. If you cannot figure out how to deal with all the different types of data out there and present it in a friendly way to your users, you have a limited shelf life out there. So I think that's what's happening, Mark. And I see our role to be a very specific service role there, right? No matter what the data source, help me go find this patient's data. And it'll take us a long time to get all the data sources connected because some of them are kind of locked away in these government agencies, especially the state and local government agencies. But we'll get there, and as we start getting there, the EHR vendors are also getting there, and in the meantime, people really are already starting to tap into those valuable sets of data. And I keep missing out the genomic data. The genomic data is probably going to be a critical piece of this whole puzzle, but it's subject to all the same constraints and forces of evolution.
We've been speaking today with Jitin Asnani, First Executive Director of the Commonwealth Health Alliance, a not-for-profit trade association of healthcare and technology organizations that are working together to create universal access to health data nationwide. You can learn more about their exciting work by going to commonwealthalliance.org or on Twitter at Commonwealth or follow him at Jitin, that's J-I-T-I-N. Jitin, thank you for your incredibly important contributions to health data interoperability, for being such a great communicator about the work that you're doing, and for joining us today on Conversations on Healthcare.
Thank you so much for having me.
At Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
In a political rally in El Paso, President Donald Trump falsely suggested that fact-checkers didn't hold then-President Barack Obama accountable for his false promise that if you like your health care plan or your doctor, you can keep them under the Affordable Care Act. We wrote as far back as 2009 that Obama couldn't make that promise to everyone. Trump said, quote, "You can keep your doctor, remember that?" And then he called out the fact checkers, saying, quote, "Hey, where are the fact checkers? You know, some of the most dishonest people in the media are the so-called fact checkers." In August 2009, we wrote that under the healthcare bills being debated at the time, some employers might have to change insurance plans to meet benefit requirements, and others could drop coverage and pay a penalty instead. The nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office estimated that 3 million people with insurance through their employers would not be offered coverage. We cited that report and explained in detail how the different versions of healthcare legislation could affect the ability of some to keep the same insurance plan. Obama had made the claim in an August 15, 2009 town hall event in Grand Junction, Colorado, as he tried to garner public support for his healthcare overhaul plan. He told the crowd, quote, "If you like your healthcare plan, you keep your healthcare plan. Nobody is going to force you to leave your healthcare plan. If you like your doctor, you keep seeing your doctor." When asked about the claim in a 2009 press conference, Obama said he meant, quote, "The government is not going to make you change plans under health reform." But we noted that's not exactly the claim he continued to make. Obama repeated his talking point over the years, and we repeatedly wrote about it. His claim made our list of healthcare whoppers in 2010, the whoppers of 2012, the early edition, and a roundup of Obamacare myths in September 2013. In October 2013, reality caught up with Obama's claim when many Americans who bought coverage on the individual market began getting letters from their insurance companies saying they'd have to buy a new policy because of the ACA's minimum benefit requirements. We wrote about that, too. The fact is, we held Obama to the same standard that we hold Trump. And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of factcheck.org.
Factcheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have factcheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare.
Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. Fitness trackers have become all the rage, especially among upwardly mobile, fitness-conscious people seeking to monitor their own health. But another trend has emerged in the age of wearable devices. After a few months, about a third of users simply stop using them. The reality captured the imagination of Tufts University School of Medicine professor Dr. Lisa Gualtieri.
And I thought, what if you could take all of these abandoned trackers and give them to the people who could benefit most from them?
She thought, what if we could get disinterested owners to donate their used fitness trackers to be repurposed and donated to underserved populations?
A lot of the work that we've been doing has been with older adults, racial and ethnic minorities, and for a lot of people, the cost is prohibitive, so I think that that's a barrier.
So in 2015, she launched her nonprofit enterprise, Recycle Health, an online social media campaign to raise awareness for her program, which seeks donated wearable devices to provide these expensive devices for free to those in need. She partnered with organizations working with low-income adults and those with mental health issues, seniors in fall prevention programs, and veterans as well.
What we do is talk to people about how active, how sedentary they are, and coming up with a reasonable and achievable goal. They might start off with 2,000, 3,000 steps as their goal, but they know how to make that higher when they're ready to.
Recycle Health, a simple repurposing of personalized wearables, providing these tools for free to vulnerable populations, empowering them to engage in activities that can improve their own health, provide useful data on using these devices to improve population health. Now that's a bright idea. You've been listening to Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare is recorded at WESU, at Wesleyan University, streaming live at chcradio.com, iTunes, or wherever you listen to podcasts. If you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We love hearing from you. The show is brought to you by the Community Health Center.